This is the current federal tax developments for the week of November the 30th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm coming to you today from Phoenix, Arizona. We're going to be talking about things that happened in federal taxes over this past shortened week. And we're first going to start out with a private letter ruling request that the IRS denied, where a taxpayer asked for a late mark-to-market election as a trader. Discuss why that didn't work, why the taxpayer was turned down, as most often will be the case, and some of the issues involving with the market mark-to-market election, as well as the issues that you can and cannot ask the IRS for relief from if you make a late, if you actually blow an election date. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. We also have final regulations that were issued a little while back, but we had a lot that happened last week, so I pushed it to this week, on the unrelated business income tax rules that were changed by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. As you may recall, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act now says that a not-for-profit organization, an exempt organization, is not allowed to combine different businesses into a single calculation for UBIT. In essence, you can't offset losses from one unrelated business against income from another. Going to find out that you add up all the positives, you don't deduct the negatives, but they become their own NOL going forward to the following years. We'll talk about how the regulations work there. The IRS also finalized some regulations we discussed earlier when they're in proposed form that deal with like-kind exchanges following the passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And we'll discuss what changed in those regulations as it came out in final form and some of the basic issues that we have to worry about there. But let's get started with this request to make a late mark-to-market election. This is private letter ruling 2020-48009, and this came out here on November the 25th. And this particular election goes back to the issues of a taxpayer who is a trader, and we never have to worry about where this taxpayer actually met the definition of a trader, but we're going to talk about the election that's there if you are. Now, generally, a trader is somebody who is not buying stocks as investments per se for hold, looking for long-term appreciation, but rather they're somebody who very, very rapidly plays very short-term swings in the market. An actual trader normally is going to have a huge number of trades every year, going into the hundreds of thousands of trades quite often that you're going to have for a various transaction as they are trying to play what may be just a few minutes variation in prices as they're trying to time things on that very short-term trade. If you are a trader, then one issue we discover with traders is quite often, there's an old quip talking about in many cases how to make a small fortune by starting with a large fortune and then doing X. Clearly, doing day trading is a place where a lot of people start with a large fortune that they made doing whatever they did, and they managed to whittle that down to a small fortune or even whittle it down to nothing by going into day trading, because this is a way you can lose a lot of money very, very quickly. And what happens is you run into the $3,000 a year cap on claiming net capital losses, because by definition, these stocks are going to be considered stocks, bonds, whatever you're doing your day trading on, are going to be considered to be a capital asset. And that raises some problems because obviously if it turns out you're not very good at this, which, hint, over the years when I've had people who have gone the trader route, there are, and my guess is, and I, this track record is probably just about right, I think overall, about 5% of traders are very, very good and make good money at it. And about 95% of them are losing their shirts very quickly. And you can certainly pour through a lot very quickly. So this could be a problem, you know, if you start out with your fortune and by the end of the year, you had managed to lose $9 million of that fortune through your day trading lack of skill. Well, you got, it's going to take quite a few years at $3,000 a year for losses to use up that $9 million loss. There is a way around this, and that's the special rules found at Section 475F. At 475F, we discussed that if you are a trader in security, you may make an election to use what's called the mark-to-market method of accounting for your securities that you're used in your trader operation. And under the mark-to-market election, what happens is, at the end of the year, anything you're holding at that date is treated as if it was sold as of the end of that day, right? And then your basis resets for the next year. If you do that, then your gains and losses will not be treated as capital any longer. They will be treated as ordinary. Now, normally you'd think, well, that's normally not a good idea, right? I mean, capital gains get these really, really great tax treatments. Yes, if they're gains, and if you held them for over a year. But as a day trader, you're not likely to hold them for more than a few minutes. And the other problem is that if you're not very good at it, you're going to generate losses. And as we're all aware, capital losses are limited to an excess of $3,000 over your capital gains for the year. That's the best you can do. Now, what 475 says is, okay, we're going to treat this all as ordinary. You have to give up that minor detail of marking them to market. But if you do that, we're going to simplify a lot of things for you. And the really nice thing is, if you do have a bad year, and again, in day trading, a bad year can be very, very bad, and you were to drop a few hundred thousand, a million in losses from your day trading business, that would be considered an ordinary loss that would lead to a net operating loss, which you could then carry back. It's also going to be helpful because if you have any other income, that loss can also offset that other income. Now, with the caveat coming up next year now, that originally came in at 18, then uncame in at 18, remember, we do have the net business loss rule that's going to pop up in 2021. That's going to cap us at no more than $250,000 of net business losses from our pass-through businesses. And in 2021, not counting W-2 wages from employment. So that could basically put kind of an overall cap, but still, $250,000 is a lot better than $3,000. And the excess will be treated as an NOL into the following year, where it's going to be subject to the 80% of taxable income cap in the future years for offset. So, okay, not as great as it was, but still probably better than $3,000 a year capital loss. But the catch with this election is, under the IRS guidance that has been issued here, you look at it under Revenue Procedure 99-17. To make this election, it must be made by the unextended due date of the tax return for the year preceding the year you want the election to take effect for. And you will also, therefore, on that return for the year you want to take effect for, you have to make an automatic accounting method change with a 3115 on the return. So that means that realistically, we need to have this election made, assuming we're going to be as an individual making this election, normally by April 15th of the year in which we want the election to apply. Bottom line, you're not allowed to wait till the end of the year and see if you want to do this or not. And part of the reason is because while probably it won't cause a problem if you make the election, because probably, you know, you're going to, if you have the losses, they're going to be more than 3,000. If you don't have a large capital gain, you can't offset that, you know, that loss is not going to be absorbed and it'll be kind of stuck in there. And if it's a gain, you make money for the year. Well, it's ordinary income and it's going to be taxed at the same rates, whether or not you make this election. And before somebody says, wait, isn't there self-employment tax you make this election? The answer is no. No, there is no self-employment tax issue if you make this election. This election does not cause problems with SE tax. That was taken care of years ago. 1402A is very clear that any gains from the sale of securities are not considered to be self-employment income, and that would also include traders. So we have this special set of rules. Now, because of that, though, you can't wait. I mean, theoretically, the problem could be maybe I have this, you know, I made all this money in my day trading operation, but I have a really big capital loss from having, you know, sold something that was otherwise a capital asset at this huge loss. Well, if it was still capital gain income in my day trading operation, I could offset it. But having made this election, which is permanent going forward, I can't do it. So you might be tempted to wait until the first year just in case that you had a loss in excess of $3,000 to make this election, on the understanding why, well, at least we kept it open just in case it turns out that we run into a problem here. So you're not allowed to do that. Now let's get to our facts in this case. The taxpayer in this case was a not terribly successful part-time day trader. Now we may get into a long discussion whether being part-time he truly was a day trader, but I'm not going to worry about that discussion right now. I will say this, though, it's not something, if you do actually do it, that you're likely to be terribly successful doing it if you're part-time. But and nevertheless, so he did this, you know, not terribly successful. He did have a discussion about the options for taxation for a day trader with his accountant. And the accountant did discuss with him the option of making an election under 475F to treat his income and losses as ordinary. But apparently no action was taken at the time they had this initial discussion. Well, there's some dispute with the taxpayer claiming that he did tell the accountant to make an election at this time, but the accountant didn't have any record of it, and the IRS didn't buy the theory either because later emails seemed to have him coming back very late in the year and asking, why don't we go ahead and make this election now? Okay, so basically stating that it certainly appears, based on what we've seen, that you made this choice after the fact. Now, even though we had discussed it, and the accountant came back and told him back and forth various items, certainly from the facts in the letter, it appears that at least this first accountant with the firm was not aware of the special due date rules for this election. In essence, how early in the year it had to be made. Because it appears when the client called up late in the year, the accountant said, oh yeah, here's the information I need. Here's what I need to do to make the election. Give me that information. We'll go ahead and we'll get this election made. So it appears that that accountant was at least giving the impression that we were going to still be able to get this election. We're going to make this election now as if it's no big deal. We're going to make it with the return. And I think may have been presuming that the 3115 was the way you did it as opposed to needing the separate election to go in. Now, later on, we get this notice suddenly that another accountant shows up on the scene with the same firm, who then writes the client and says, which is kind of interesting, you know, as you were told by the first accountant, you know, it is too late to make this election. And like, you know, well, the first thing is it didn't appear the first accountant remembered they had told them that, but apparently they're claiming somewhere they had a record of it. Again, the fact pattern here is kind of a little bit iffy with this thing that went in, so we don't truly know how this worked, except we do know that there's at least that dispute as to whether it was asked to file it early in the year or not. And said, you know, so we can't make this election timely. However, we could try for a special ruling here under Regulation 301-9100-2. Now, 301-9100-2 is a special option, or dash 3, I should say. Dash 3 is a special set of rules. The 301-9100-2 has two options for getting automatic relief for late regulatory elections. Actually, in one case, any election. And there are two rules called the 6-month rule and the 12-month rule. Now, the 12-month rule is very, very limited to very specific things that you didn't timely elect. But if you do that, as long as you do the election at 12 months of the date you should have done it, you're fine. The 6-month rule just allows you to make an election by the extended due date of a return, even if you didn't go on extension. If you failed to make it on the original return, that one's kind of in there just to not to have everybody believe they should wait till the last second to file their returns. So in case they think about an election they should have made, they'll put it in on time. You know, going to let you come in a little bit earlier. So that's kind of the background we're on there. Now, the catch here is they decided to try to go in and get this relief under 301-9100-3. Well, this is where you go to the IRS. You don't qualify for automatic relief. So the relief we're going to have to get is going to be relief that we can only get if the IRS grants us that relief, and you have to go for this relief via a private letter ruling. In essence, there is no other option. The regulation makes it very clear right off the bat that you're going to have to go for a private letter ruling, and that means paying the fee for one. In addition, the IRS requires the taxpayer to demonstrate two things in order to obtain this relief. First, the taxpayer must demonstrate that the taxpayer acted reasonably and in good faith with regard to this issue and were just, you know, failed to make the election due to what's essentially reasonable cause. Right? It may have been, and one way that quite often does work is if you had relied on advice from an accountant who admits now that they gave you bum advice, they didn't know about the election, et cetera, et cetera. And so the election was not made. You know, they weren't sure what to do it, et cetera. So you relied on bad advice or some other ways to do it. And the second category is you have to show the grant of relief will not prejudice the interest of the government. Now, there are a couple of key issues here, though, with this particular type of election that makes it very difficult to get this relief. The IRS is aware. The reason they set it so early in the year was exactly for the reason I mentioned. They did not want people waiting until the end of the year to decide to make that election, you know, waiting and not making it till the first year that it's clear it would be advantageous to them. So they want you to commit early if you're going to go down this path. You cannot go down this path essentially after the due date of the return for the year previous unless it is absolutely your first year, which for an individual, it's not going to be in most cases if you're day trading. Not many infants start day trading instantly. So we probably, and most people don't start day trading as the first thing that requires them to file a tax return. So because of that, you know, we generally are not going to get this relief. And part of the deal is the regulations tell us a couple of things. First thing is, under Regulation 301-900-3B3III, it is not considered to be acting in good faith if you are asking for relief where clearly you have a significant benefit from hindsight, unless you can show strong proof that the decision to seek relief did not involve the use of hindsight in any way, shape, or form. And obviously, in this case, you know, we kind of know. In this case, this taxpayer had losses, true, prior to the date the election had to be made. But clearly, that was early in the year. And then he had additional significant losses after that date in the year. So we have a problem here with hindsight. As well, if a election involves a change of accounting method, it is presumed, in absence of unusual and compelling circumstances, that the grant of relief would prejudice the interest of the government. And because of that, the idea is that we're going to deny it. And there are four catches here for a change of method. And two of them are going to be a bit of a problem for the taxpayer. One is a key problem. If there is or would be required to have a 41A election, remember that whole mark-to-market routine. That'll require a 41A, not election, 41A adjustment to be made. And this particular change of method does utilize the 481A rules. So because of that, we have a problem. And then secondly, you know, if it provides a more favorable method of accounting or more favorable terms and conditions, if the election is made by a certain date or taxable year. Arguably, maybe that one's in there. But the first category, the 41A adjustment, is clearly in play. Now, the IRS says, look, the first thing is we're going to say, no, you did not act reasonably and in good faith. And they're saying it's clear you had a major benefit of hindsight by not making the election early in the year and being able to put it off till later. And there is no evidence that you had committed to the election ahead of time. The taxpayer does claim that, you know, he did. He told the accountant right away to do it. And there's an implication, because this was in a footnote. And they said, well, no, we don't buy that because there's clearly other facts that indicate, nope, you made the decision well after that date. But the existence of the footnote does indicate that there might have been a chance, minor as it may be, of showing unusual and compelling circumstances that would get you beyond, that would make it reasonable basis if you could have shown that you actually had, let's say, asked the accountant to make the election on a timely basis, and the accountant had failed to, you know, deal with that. We get into this whole area about whether you should have known of the date, and if you should have, do we get to like the Boyle situation where we're looking at that for filing returns, where you can't push that off on a third party. But obviously we didn't get there at this point because, as I said, that we don't believe you actually asked the accountant to make this election prior to the due date. We believe that is kind of, in hindsight, you're arguing that because you figured out that, well, I better say that or otherwise I'm not going to be able to carry any of this. And then the second problem they said was, would it prejudice the interests of the government? And they said, yeah, it clearly would, right? Again, we have this huge advantage of hindsight situation where we have this situation where the accountant, as we said, you know, the accountant didn't really seem to have told him, or he never indicated he was going to make this election early in the year. And it appears that we have the good faith. For both of these reasons, the taxpayer was not successful. Now, if you do have a taxpayer who's a trader, a couple of things you probably want to do. Reading between the lines of this, with the dispute between the accounting firm apparently and the client, you certainly get the feeling that there's some claim coming up here. You just kind of read between and go, that could be an issue. You want to make sure that when you talk to a client about this first, make sure you understand that rule. It's very important how early this election must be made. Number two, you want to make sure that you document in writing that you've told the client about the election and that you told them about the date by which they have to have a decision, and that you told them that as of right now, you're not making that election unless the client does X, Y, Z and understands that this election will need to go in by that date. So a decision must be made by that date. And document in writing, because clients have amazingly bad memories when it comes to issues like this. Just fair warning. That's the sort of thing they've got. So interesting case, interesting rule. Now, the 301-900-2 can be useful if you have a situation where there was reliance on the accountant and, you know, it just bad advice was given or you just didn't know, you know, you might be able to justify. And certainly we see cases like that allowed where people have failed to make elections timely and the accountant was willing to fall on their sword as part of the private letter request, indicate that, yes, I had failed to notify them of this. And the client reasonably would have made the election. Clearly, you know, it's just I failed to let them know. And we have seen relief. But this issue, almost never do we see relief on this. I can only recall one private letter ruling ever that I can recall got relief on this late election. And that dealt with a case where there was a reasonable belief the election has already been made, as opposed to because they had a change of entity type, which meant they should have reelected. But they didn't realize they had to reelect, and yeah, that's one case where we've seen a, you know, it wasn't hindsight. Clearly, you reasonably believed that the election was still good. Next up, we have a couple of final regs this week, and we'll cover these here at this point. First one is Treasury Decision 9933, issued on November 20th of 2020. And this is the final regulations for the unrelated business income tax rules following the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Now, if you remember the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, this changed the rules to state essentially, if an exempt organization has more than one trade or business, they're not allowed to offset the losses from any of those trade or businesses against income from the others. Rather, you have to wait until that particular trade or business ultimately has enough income to absorb its prior NOLs in order to be able to then offset it against the income from other unrelated trade or businesses. And that won't offset, you'll just add it in. So you have to be able to absorb that loss. Now, the IRS does state right off there are a couple of issues that they still need to issue regulations on. And they do say the first issue is going to be allocation expenses, depreciation, similar items between the exempt and unrelated activity, or between more than one unrelated activity. They expect to issue more regs there. And the other problem is how the changes made to NOL rules under the CARES Act affect this, because originally these rules came in at the same time you lost the loss carry forward rule, or you lost the loss carry back rules. So we didn't have to worry about carrying these losses back to a prior year where we hadn't worried about how many trades or businesses we had. Now we're going to have to try to figure out how to do that. And we may very well be carrying back into years where, you know, there simply isn't any information, or we don't have the information because we didn't know we needed it, to divide this up into the proper sets of trade or businesses. Now, one of the key things obviously here is how to decide if you have more than one trade or business. And the IRS did specifically reject looking at analyses like we do for 199 Cap A, where we looked at the regs under 1.446 to decide if we have multiple trades or businesses. They said, well, there you're looking at separating trades or businesses, and honestly, that reg tends to most often come up with you don't have one, and so the service didn't feel that that was really what Congress was going for. So we're going to be using now, for this particular point, the North American Industry Classification System codes. Now, under the original proposed regs, this would have been the six-digit codes. But on the final regs, they agreed that those were way, way too specific, and that, in fact, you could end up with a lot of things that would be reasonably viewed by the charity as a single business that would nevertheless be split into like 25 odd sub-businesses because of breaking down our codes into that super level of detail that could make minorly different things into separate trades or businesses that we'd then have to allocate expenses among and figure out if we had income or loss from each one. So the IRS agrees instead that we're going to use what's essentially the two-digit front-end codes. And so what they suggest you do is you take a look, you find maybe the best six-digit code that describes a part of the trades or businesses, and then everything that relates to the same initial two-digit code on that six-digit code will be considered a single trade or business, right? That's going to be the takeaway. And they're very clear. Everything you do that fits within that two-digit code, whether you view it as separate trade or business or not, maybe they're in separate geographic locations, you know, that it doesn't matter how you view it. You will only use that code once, and that code will be what you will accumulate your income or losses under for purposes of this rule, right? And basically then, yes, you do that. And when we get to taxing it, bottom line, you take each one of those separate two-digit codes, you determine your net income or loss from each one of those, and then you add up for your overall subject to tax unrelated business income. And what you're going to effectively do is, after applying any losses to the individual businesses that are post-2017, absorbing their prior losses, what you're going to end up doing is then offsetting, or I should say, adding up every trade or business that has a positive unrelated business income number, add those up, and anyone that has negative, you're going to treat as zero in making the calculation. So that's what you'll do, and those losses will go forward separately. Okay. Now, they do have a special rule that goes into a lot of detail, and we've kind of talked about this before in the past when they first raised this in an IRS notice, but there is this special category which is going to be called the activities in the nature of investments, or investment activities. They will form a single trade or business. And these activities include basically the total of three things, two of which are brand new to this concept here: qualifying partnership interests, qualifying S corporation interests, and then debt finance property or properties within the meaning of Section 514. It becomes unrelated business income. Now, that last category has been around for a long time, but the first two categories are a little bit interesting, and they are very similar. Basically, you're going to take, and they're looking for here where maybe a tax-exempt organization has gone out and bought some partnership interest, right? They've invested in a partnership, in a publicly traded partnership, let's say, primarily for investment return, right? But it does have unrelated business income coming out of it. So they're going to say, well, you're going to take all of those partnerships, if you meet these two requirements, and treat them as a single trade or business. I don't care what business they're in. So we're going to treat those, and we're going to add up then all the qualifying S corporations you might hold interest in. And we're going to take that into the total plus this debt finance stuff. And we're going to treat that whole category as a single trader business, regardless of what the underlying businesses inside of those partnerships or S corporations may be doing. Now, to do this, you have to meet two tests. One is called the de minimis test, and the other is called the participation test. And if you meet those two rules, generally, you're allowed to get out. Now, there is one big exception. Social clubs under 501(c)(3)(7) cannot use the qualified partnership income or qualified S corporation income rules. So if you're in that category, you can. And number two, any interest you hold as a general partner in a partnership can never be a qualifying partnership interest, in which case then you got to kind of look inside and find the businesses there because you're presumed now to have an actual activity in the business. But the general rule is for de minimis is you cannot hold at any point during the year, right? You can't hold, or I should say on average during the year, you have to have no more than 2% of the profits interest and no more than 2% of the capital interest of this activity. Well, if you're going out there and buying, you know, a few units of, let's say, Plains All American Public Traded Partnership, you're going to be well under 2% ownership most likely, unless you've got a really, really big charitable investment group going. So theoretically is you would pick those up, or at least you'd meet the de minimis test. And you do compute your percentage using averages. You can use what the partnership, generally you can use whatever the partnership tells you, beginning in any capital. So you can rely on the K-1s to have that come out. That's going to work with you. So that's fine. You know, we have that part going. So that works just fine for us. And then the other part is going to be the participation test. And for participation tests, first thing is we can't hold any more than 20% of the capital interest during a taxable year in which the partnership you're in computes the same fashion as for the de minimis test. And secondly, the organization does not significantly participate in the partnership. And significant participation in the partnership is taking a look at basically, you know, getting involved if you can basically get the, if you can force the partnership to do certain things, if anybody with the organization participates in management, if the organization can appoint the board, etc., there are various things that will kick you in for participation and how you will fail that. Okay. But if you meet those two tests, which again, with your standard investment partnership, you're going to meet the two tests, be fine. There is a special rule if you don't meet the test because of the actions of another partner. You're allowed to look back to the prior year. And if you met the test the prior year, you can still do it. If the only reason you're going to miss it is because of this unrelated partner who probably had their interest redeemed, but realized that's only good for 1 year. And there is a special rule as well that will go away quickly that you can read about that will involve a transition rule for certain interests that were held prior to August 21st of 2018. But that pretty much will go away at the end of this year. So next year, that rule won't work. S corporation qualifying interests essentially use virtually the same test. Same pair of tests will get you this qualifying S interest. Now, if you have an S interest, though, that's not qualifying, then by definition, an S corporation, everything from a single S corporation is always a separate trader business. So again, we're going to ice, and it doesn't matter, therefore, if it might be logically be able to be combined with something else you're doing. You have an S corporation where you fail the test because you own too much, or you have too much control, then we're going to have the same problem, shall we say, to kick it in as a separate entity. There are special rules where income coming from certain controlled organizations, like controlled foreign corporations and other controlled tax-exempt entities have to be aggregated in. We have that background as we go. There's also a special rule, and we talk about the NOL rules. They discuss their NOLs coming from prior to 2018. Can offset all income without limitation. Okay, we don't have any special limitation to figure out where those NOLs came from. But once we get to a 2018 NOL, we have to do that special allocation. Again, we do not yet have guidance as to what do we do about that post-2017 NOL that we could apparently carry back and what the restrictions are on that. That is a to-be-announced issue for the IRS. Finally, I wanted to tell you this week that we do have one other thing. We talked about the proposed rules that came out a little bit here, so I just want to briefly discuss what's new. These are the final regulations on like-kind exchanges following the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Treasury Decision 9935, main regulation here is 1.1031-3, and these came out on the 23rd of November. Now, we talked about the proposed regs when they came out in much more detail earlier this year, so I'm not going to go through that detail now. Let's talk about those, some of the key changes. And probably the major change we had was that we got rid of, previously, we had a single federal definition looking at old federal law rules for what was considered to be real property. Remember, following the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you can only do a 1031 exchange on real property. So if something is not real property, you can't do a 1031 exchange, or it can't, or that will not be qualified property, will be treated as receipt of that property, will be treated as boot, and any gain inherent on that property when you get rid of it would be recognized because it wouldn't qualify for deferral. So the question is, what's real property? Originally, they used a standard federal definition that we've seen in other places, because they wanted one for across the country. Well, a lot of people complained about that, said especially in this context, it should really be what state law says is real property. That should be a state law definition. And the IRS relented on this. So yes, for the most part, we're going to use state law definition of property with a few special cases under the reg where the IRS adds stuff back in. So basically, we're going to see or have certain exclusions, very limited. But for the most part, you're going to look at, does the state that where the property's in, does that state treat that as real property? If it does, it will qualify for exclusion. And then you take a look at a few special rules, especially on intangible items, as to whether they're considered to be real property or not. The IRS also got use of what had been the purpose or use test. Under the proposed regulations, even if something otherwise would seem to be real property, because it's not meant to be removed from the property, it seems permanently attached, but its purpose or use was not consistent with that of a building. For instance, it was a big piece of machinery. The example they gave was a 3D printer that was, you know, kind of latched into the building, became part of the building. Effectively became part of the building, because if you tried to take it out, you'd have to, like, you know, tear out. It would be, you almost have to disassemble the building to get it out. But they said, but because the purpose of that was being a manufacturing piece of equipment, that, you know, you weren't allowed to treat it as real property. They backed off that. So they actually changed two examples we'll talk about here in just a second. But they actually changed a couple of examples where they had made use of this purpose or use test to take property out of the real property category. But I suppose the good news is, well, with state-local tests versus not, that probably expanded the list of property that qualified, but not necessarily. But on this one, it's pretty clear that this second, getting rid of the purpose and use test, will expand what qualifies for the exchange. They also changed a couple of examples. They had an example previously, as I said, about a hard-to-relocate big piece of machinery. It was a 3D printer. They also had a turbine that was in there in a similar set of problems. In this case, both they put in the example, they tell us that both been considered real property under the Apple state law. So because of that, it will still be real property. We don't worry about the fact that the use of it is, quote, inconsistent, you know, with the general use of a building. So we're okay there. And they also give us a brand new example for state and local definition of real property. They do delete, or basically combined example, is previously with the 3D printer, they had had a couple of different examples. They had one where the 3D printer in the original proposed regulation, you had a 3D printer and you had a generator that provided electricity for the entire building. The generator was, even though it's equipment style stuff, because it provided power for the entire building, and that's a building activity, was considered to be real property, except if the generator only provided power for the 3D printer, which, remember, the old proposed regs was not real property, then the generator would not be real property. Yeah, they got rid of that second example, and now they just have the generator's always real property, right, as is the 3D printer. And it doesn't matter whether it was to power the 3D printer or to power the building as a whole. It's irrelevant. And they added, like we said, a brand new one for pointing out that we're now using state and local definitions. Well, like I said, it's kind of brief this week. Not much has been happening. And we are getting toward the end of CPE season. It's still fast and furious for the next few weeks. But, you know, we kind of get into that because most CPAs, once we get to December 15th, you know, your mind starts turning to things other than continuing education. So I do have a couple of courses coming up I want to remind you of. Again, as always this year, everything we're doing this year is going to be online through the end of the year. We had some on and off as to whether that was going to be true or not. Eventually, obviously, the situation didn't change dramatically. We still have all of these special rules and all of these, you know, issues where people would not necessarily be comfortable coming. And more to the point, even if they were comfortable coming, reality is that we have all of these rules about having to quarantine if you travel. So the problem is that realistically, we can't be sure, even if everybody could come in, everybody wanted to come in, that I, as an instructor, could actually get there without having to come in 2 weeks early, which makes it a little bit tough if I'm supposed to do other courses. So again, all online. But the good news about all online is that wherever you are, you can attend these. The first course we're going to be doing on the 10th of December. This right now, I think, is the final one I'm scheduled to do with a four-hour session on the PPP loan forgiveness structure. So if you're in the New Hampshire Society area, you're a member of the New Hampshire Society of CPAs, you can go ahead and look into signing up for that on the 10th. I also, the next day, will be doing a course for the WISE Society, this one on cannabis, right? Accounting, auditing, and tax considerations for the cannabis industry. My emphasis is always pretty heavily on the tax side, which is where it's a lot more interesting as far as I'm concerned. But we will talk about some of the ethical issues CPAs run into, some of the exposures, and some of the other issues in that regard. That will be the next day on the 11th. Both of these courses that I'm putting you for the 10th and 11th, both of these are four-hour sessions. So again, if you want to sign up for those, check the relevant state society website, and you can see your information about registering for the course and being ready to take the course when we're ready to go. You know, we'll be using various systems. I believe we're using Kaplan system for Hawaii. I'm not sure which online system I'm using for New Hampshire at this point. So we'll check. I've gotten used to running a lot of different online systems to do these. Most of them are pretty similar, but yeah, just have different ways of going. Remember, this has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of November the 30th, right? We finished up. We're past Thanksgiving. We're heading into December. You can basically get information. You can contact me online if you have questions, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. My Twitter handle is @edzollers. If you are a member of the state societies for Arizona, Illinois, Minnesota, New Jersey, or Washington, I do keep track of those societies' postings to their Connect sites. So if you have any issues or questions, and I think I can be of help, I'll probably put some information in. So if you have those there, take a look, make use of them. They are very useful resources for all kinds of reasons, especially anything that deals with state and local tax issues. Great place to get help outside of your own firm and organization. And if you're a one-person operation, getting help within your own firm or organization may be looking in the mirror. So you can get a little bit better there. But again, we look forward. I'll see about, we come back next week for our first December session, and we'll talk about what's been happening in December and kind of see how we're going and try to work up everything else and look forward to that. We'll see what else comes up. Congress will apparently be coming back. We are told they have some sort of deal on the year-end spending. Whether that means we'll get any sort of tax provisions hooked to it is open. If I had to bet, I would say no this year. But again, they're keeping it quiet, so we don't know what's in there, so we'll keep our eye on it. But otherwise, look forward to see you guys come back here next week for more current federal tax developments.